Hi there, this is Mike Knezovich again, and welcome to the latest edition of Tune Up with Mike and Monty, Thinking and Feeling Good. This series is basically brain science step by step. It's not brain science for dummies because you're not dummies, but it is a difficult topic, and Dr. Monty Papaluri helps break it down in ways that even I can understand. So I'm here today in Chicago with Dr. Papaluri on a lovely, lovely Tuesday morning in Chicago. It's probably 40 degrees and the sun is shining, and if it's February and you have weather like this in Chicago, you're thankful. So anyway, how are you today, Monty?
I'm doing great, Mike. That's truly how it is. Springy.
Yeah, and it's been an easy winter. Sorry, here in Chicago, we talk about the weather because the weather is a big part of our lives. Anyway, in this installment, we're going to talk about impulse control and, more to the point, the mechanisms in the brain of impulse and impulse control. I think it's pretty easy to understand impulses on a basic level because we all have them. You know, I mean, everybody knows the phrase impulse purchase. You know, it's the candy bars at the checkout lane at the supermarket. And so that's kind of a lighthearted view of it. But and obviously we all have impulses, but things can go wrong if we don't know how to manage them. And there are mechanisms that create these impulses, and when they're different in different people. So I guess the first question I have, Monty, is when do impulses rise to being a problem rather than just something that we all have, and why does it matter to understand where they come from?
Well, let's talk maybe about why it's important to begin with. You know, impulse control is, as you said, ability to inhibit urge to act in inappropriate manner or postpone that immediate gratification, often involving a degree of, your mind or cognitive self-control and inhibition that is socially acceptable for those around you.
Mm-hmm.
So such control is still developing, as you know, in young children. And it's very important to understand this because in National Center for Health Statistics, there are over 13,000 adolescent deaths in the United States each year. And 3/4 of these deaths result from motor vehicle accidents or unintentional injuries or homicides and suicides. And this is published by Eaton way back in 2006, but only these numbers are rising by the day, especially in Chicago, as you know.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's an emergency to understand what underlies such impulse control problems in teenagers. And additionally, I think it's important to understand that it's impaired across several psychiatric disorders. Everyone knows attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where
mm-hmm.
kids tend to be very impulsive,
yep.
With associated inattention. And then bipolar disorder, where folk get disinhibited, especially in mania, and substance abuse problems, or Tourette syndrome, where you yell out obscenities or you're impulsive in motoric activity that's not in your control, or gambling. Intermittent explosive disorder is another one where you become very aggressive and then feel and act out and then feel guilty afterwards, and it's episodic and occasional. And then there are disorders that actually impair our front of the brain, that is prefrontal cortex, such as traumatic brain injury, where you have accidents
mm-hmm.
that affect your front part of the brain, like in war victims or soldiers, drug-induced states as well, where brain tends to be disinhibited under the influence of various illicit drugs that are used. So any number of these things could occur in addition to your basic impulse control problems that we all experience day to day, and then we keep that under check.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think, well, first off, that 13,000 number of adolescent deaths in the United States each year, it's kind of striking to me. I didn't realize that that I don't know what percentage of that is, but it's higher than I would have thought it would be, and that, and it makes sense up to a point, since I think we know on a sort of a intuitive sense that kids make bad decisions all the time, or they are more impulsive, but I didn't realize that it was fatal in so many cases. But besides that, I look at this, it's funny because we call this, I think sometimes it would be like judgment, I think we tend to think of it in terms of like a skill that you learn, judgment, and that's judgment is how you, control your impulsivity, but there are real hardcore mechanisms in how this, and so, obviously we learn how to resist impulses, but that learning process is something about learning, like seeking rewards, but balancing that against risk, and what happens with kids? How do they learn or not learn that? What's worth the risk and what to sort of not do?
Yeah, I mean, what is, without repeating actually the marshmallow experiments and all those things that were written about, I would like to explain basically directly about brain today.
Okay.
In case of development and developing brain in children and teenagers, it's interesting. Think about children as having immature prefrontal cortex, or the decision-making brain at the front of the brain,
mm-hmm.
and also immature subcortical or small structures at the base of the brain called the limbic system, the amygdala, and the striatal system, which is also called basal ganglia. So these things at the bottom of the brain and top of the brain, both of them are immature in children. Okay. And in adults, both these are mature.
Okay.
So the middle part, that is the teenagers, the middle age, is when the teenage portion, the adolescent portion, is where the basal ganglia, that is the striatal system, it's also called striatal system, and also the amygdala is very mature because they're old parts of the brain, and the prefrontal cortex, or the decision-making brain at the front part or the top part of the brain, is still developing. So the what happens is that the teenagers tend to overreact, and because they receive the impulse or stimuli-driven kind of impulses are felt both at basal ganglia level, where they love the reward, they like the reward, they want the reward, and at the same time, the amygdala reacts and says, I want it, and also it is very excitable.
Mm-hmm.
So the excitability created by amygdala, and then the need to have it, or the liking of things and seeking reward driven by striatum, are both like in full force and well developed in teenagers, whereas the prefrontal cortex, or the front part of the brain that is supposed to inhibit this to a socially acceptable level, is still developing. Therefore, this overactivity at the bottom of the brain drives these teenagers to be impulsive, relative to even children or adults, you know? And so what happens then is they end up making risky choices. And this is very well documented by Reina and Farley in 2006, that these adolescents know the right from the wrong. But it's not about them knowing the right from the wrong, really, right? It is the development that's documented by Hare and his colleagues in 2007, and several of them actually wrote subsequently, like Ernst, Galvin, all those people in last decade, about this risk-taking and reward-seeking in teenagers out of proportion to other ages.
So a teenager... I think a lot of parents would, it wouldn't make their life any easier, but it would maybe help soothe them to understand that this behavior isn't really like a character thing necessarily. It's just a state of development, and that, and it's not that they don't have a role in it, but it's, in a sense, this bad behavior is kind of normal and to be expected.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk later about you know, intervention, but one thing I want to add now, though, is while we kind of hold teenagers being impulsive, blah, 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 I think that the even the adults have these problems. Also, and Aaron Poldrack and other colleagues have also done research where the prefrontal cortex has, you know, where the Mickey Mouse ears are, that, that kind of place in the prefrontal cortex is called a dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, top left part of the brain.
Okay.
And those areas, that area actually, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, both in function and structure, grow slowly and with age. And it is predictive, you know, how thick this dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is and how active or engaged this region is important in strategic decision making, actually. You know, you know, the adults also can be mature sometimes. It's based linearly or somewhat proportionately to these dorsolateral prefrontal cortex ability to function appropriately in being able to strategize with age and also the brain maturity.
So adults could struggle with the same thing, and it can be related to like this, the DLPFC.
Right.
The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, frontal cortex. I said that just to prove I could. might be developed differently in different individuals, and it might be linked to the to even impulse control in adults.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So there's this sort of. I mean, I think we tend to think of this also as a layman, like this is an emotional thing, this inability to, say, lashing out or just going out and doing whatever I feel like doing because I want to at that time. I tend to think of it as an emotional thing. But so what's the relationship between emotion and impulse control, and are they the same thing?
Yes, yeah. I mean, you asked a very kind of nice question. I think this is my favorite thing to think about is how emotions impact impulse control, you know? I mean, an important detail here to remember is, like, I'm going to introduce you an area called ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. You know, there are many parts in prefrontal cortex that act like a CEO, right? So we talked in the past about emotional control region at the lateral base of the brain called ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, VLPFC. This ventrolateral prefrontal cortex is like a CEO that controls the emotions. And this region is fascinating in that response inhibition or inhibiting your motor control problems as well as emotions, both of them are kind of moderated or controlled by this region called ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. So when you are talking about impulse and emotions, both of them are driven by this very critical region. And instead of like, you know, several experiments actually by Brown and colleagues have shown that it's not that emotions increase impulse or impulse control problems increase emotional disturbance, but it's additive. You know, they both linearly, additively combine their impact in how you react. You know, it's not like one is subservient to the other or one pushes the other,
but
they both together additively work on how we express ourselves in controlling and how emotions impact inhibition and vice versa. Sometimes, you know, we're excited about something and we tend to be also impulsive
at the same time.
And they go hand in hand. See, imagine some excitable people who also make impulsive choices. You know, in the same way, impulsive people tend to get very excitable. So you kind of see this trend in your family and friends and even in disorders for that matter. You know, any disorder such as bipolar disorder or ADHD for that matter, even when you're excitable, then you also have impulse control issues, you know.
Okay.
So
you go up, those go up and down together in a sense, and but they don't cause each other. They're sort of,
they're additive,
But this is, I can't, it's not like I'm totally understanding this, but what's clear in this, as we talk about different topics, is the way these areas of the brain are connected to each other, and how you can't, I mean, I think a lot of us like to think this little part of my brain relates to this activity or behavior, and this little part of my brain says this is why I am a certain kind of person, but it's just way more complicated than
that. Yeah,
it
is really complicated because entire brain works together like a bunch of networks. Like, think of electrical system in your house, how they all are connected and interconnected. And sometimes, you know, when there is too much electricity, you know, used by one device, then sometimes even it gets shut down.
Right.
Brain is a little bit like that, you know. And so actually, it's interesting that you mentioned how the brain works as a complex system, because there are a lot of attentional regions that also are involved when you are emotional and impulsive, where your concentration, your ability to kind of pay attention also plays a role. You're scanning with your eye, you are thinking with your brain, you are making strategic decisions, and so the brain, how it's connected from one region to the other, is so fascinating. In fact, the research in human beings is not the only one that we learn from. We also learn, Mike, from animal studies, and in a very intricate fashion, actually. For example, the prefrontal cortex within the rats is connected to, say, nucleus accumbens, which is a striatal or basal ganglia region.
And we talked about that.
Last month. And that region in rats is connected to prefrontal cortex. And when that is disrupted, then the rats tend to be more impulsive. But what is fascinating is within that little nucleus accumbens, there are outer region called shell and the inner region called the core. And when the connection to the shell is impaired, then the rats made commission errors. And then when the connection to the central part of the nucleus accumbens is disrupted, they did more omission errors. So the attention is impaired. So the commission or the impulse control is impaired with the outer shell problem connectivity. And then the inner connectivity to the inner part of that little region resulted in more attention problems. So there are so many things that can go wrong at so many levels that we learn from animal studies and then we apply to humans, because you can't quite cut the brain and examine, or, you know, there are no invasive procedures to examine a living human being, right? So this is how we learn, you know, by translating science across the species.
So what I'm just curious about this impaired communication, what condition creates that between the shell and the
prefrontal cortex. Yeah. I mean, it could be present, you know, in these rats where they examined, they actually, create lesions in these circuits.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I'm saying.
You can create
those lesions, and potentially these problems exist in all those disorders that we talked about.
Right.
In frontostriatal systems like ADHD and bipolar disorder, Tourette's, gambling, and traumatic brain injury, substance abuse, all those problems.
Can create this.
Yeah.
This communication problem.
Potentially.
But we know the mechanism, so something's probably working there. It's just, it could be any number of things that cause that. So, I guess at some point, you know, in clinical practice, or, you know, you see people and they have some form of impulse control problem. How do you figure out how to treat a person like that, or how do you tailor a treatment program for them?
So, because we are talking about brain and how we translate the treatment brain mechanisms to treatment, I would like to essentially, you know, help our listeners to understand one critical thing, you know, When the brain is working effectively and efficiently, there are two mechanisms that are going on at any time to control the impulses. One is the direct pathway from prefrontal cortex to the subcortical regions. Called the direct pathway. Generally, that's involved in globally helping us to stop from reacting, generally being inhibited overall. Mm-hmm. Then there is another one that's a quick one. Oh my God, you can't do anything like that. You know, say for example, when I was little and when I was young and went to this, convent where there are nuns and you know, actually I was a teenager when, you know, and then all these nuns were like very strict and no matter what we're doing, we have to be very quiet. So mm-hmm. that's like, we know that when they're around, we have to be extremely
disciplined. That's the thing that tells
that is
you,
like
don't
a general,
do it.
Don't do it.
Right.
Whatever it is, they won't let you do it. Not even singing a song when we were in an excursion to Sri Lanka, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't, you know, like they're very strict. So the other ones would be the indirect pathway or that is the hyperdirect pathway. And then there is another one called indirect pathway that goes through many synapses and links, that is links in the neural system that goes from prefrontal cortex to the striatum, and that's usually involved when you know already ahead of time what are the kinds of things that you can inhibit and need to be inhibited and what are the consequences and strategy. And you know, if you do a certain thing, then you know that, you know, someone is going to yell at you. So, you know, or if you do a certain thing, then your parent is going to punish you for it. So you kind of not do it. So this is translated in very intricate fMRI studies of do it selectively inhibit and versus generally inhibit, etc.
Quick fMRI being functional MRI.
Functional magnetic.
It's a thing where you have an MRI like while real time.
Yeah, okay. Right.
And you see what's going on in the brain during
Right. So the you know, several people like Mink and Nambu and you know, like a couple of decades ago have done research on these direct and indirect pathways in animals, and subsequently actually it is shown in experiments that foreknowledge of consequences and strategy essentially trains our brain to control our impulses, and this is translated into neuroscience-based treatments or cognitive behavioral therapies. So what is fascinating though here mm-hmm. is that because emotions are involved, and if there is emotional excitability in certain disorders, mm-hmm. The punishment can also rev up, the idea of punishment can also rev up emotional systems in a destructive way. So when they're too excitable emotionally with negative stimuli, they can get really angry and upset. And impulse can be impulse control can be really hard. So any foreknowledge and strategy could also be more influential in being able to help them understand life consequences rather than also, oh my God, your mom is going to hit you if you do this, or your mom is going to take away your bike if you do this. It's more than that. You know, you want to be sophisticated in thinking of how to manage emotional systems along with impulse control systems in tandem when you are helping them to learn the foreknowledge of consequences in life in a much, much more methodical manner. And that is today's much developed informed cognitive behavioral therapy based on the brain mechanisms that we know now.
Okay, so the cognitive behavioral therapy is something that there's no one way to do it, but to make it successful, you have to understand the complex workings of the brain.
Yes.
To identify what treatment would make most sense.
What treatment would make sense, especially because the impulse control and emotional control brain circuitry systems are interlinked. Similarly, the motor control systems, which are slightly overlapping with the impulse control systems, you know, where you inhibit your hands and legs and, you know, like mm-hmm. and those kinds of, like, motor restlessness. They're all kind of interlinked, and so it is very important to recognize the complexity so that the cognitive behavioral therapies should take into account these neuroscience-based mechanisms that would inform the kind of nuances of treatment in any specific disorder that is likely to be idiosyncratic across, and a blanket CBT is not going to work with every kid or every disorder or every adult for that matter, okay?
Yeah, so if I'm a parent, it's really important for me to understand that, and I think about my teenager.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, I understand that some of this is normal, but I'm still trying to teach my teenager to manage it. When it's out of bounds to the point where I feel like we need to seek help, it's important to understand that it's a complex problem and that you probably want to find a professional that you can believe understands that.
Yeah, and also there is a lot of future to help translate science to service to clinicians as we stand now and, you know, elevate the platform of service delivery
mm-hmm.
that science is informing us right now.
Right.
And that is where you get the best results in treatment.
Well, and it's also interesting to me just when you're talking about the punishment can actually make it worse. Because it is sort of on a kind of like layman's level, you go, if you want to change your behavior, just deny, you know, punish it by denying some kind of privilege or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's a really important thing, I think, to understand that could actually make it worse, the very thing that you're trying to.
Small consequences and, you know, provided they're balanced with positive rewards in normal children, teenagers, and even adults is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's when there is a huge problem of excessive use of consequential kind of punishments.
Mm-hmm.
And in case of disorders where there is an impairment in brain function, then there are more challenges. And what is conventionally understood will not be applicable in that situation.
Okay. Well, again, this has been very helpful and fascinating, and I know more about my brain and why I acted the way I did when I was 17 years old. I think my mom...
You're fine, Mike.
My mom would have loved to have had this, I think, back in the day. But anyway, that wraps up this episode on impulse control, and thanks for listening today. And Moni, until next time.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and hope you enjoy it and send us your comments. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.